From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, international observers for the elections are being told by Texas Attorney General Greg Abbott to watch their step and to not observe.
It shouldn't be a case of being insulting. We're here to provide assistance in this question. And there really is no electoral process that couldn't be improved in some way.
The way Texas educates its school children is going on trial. We'll hear what's at stake for the state's funding mechanism for public schools.
So it'll be up to the Texas legislature to decide where to find the money if the court says you have to find it.
And 150 years ago this month, the Great Hanging of Gainesville, Texas took place. Why this ugly episode of Texas history isn't well remembered.
They were loyal citizens of the United States of America and didn't give a damn about the conflubacy. So that's why they got hanged.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Texas Attorney General Greg Abbott is convinced that election fraud is rampant in the state and that it's so bad there needs to be voter ID laws in place to fight it. However, Abbott, a Republican, says he doesn't want any international observers sticking their European schnozzolas into Texas ballot boxes on Election Day to make sure that the polling is on the up and up. The state's top prosecutor doesn't want any gray poupon near the election sites, and he is threatening criminal charges if the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe observes democracy Texas-style. Thomas Reimer is a spokesperson for the OSCE, Office for Democratic Institutions and Human Rights.
There are actually, well, first of all, our mission to the United States general elections includes two parts, a core team that's in Washington, D.C., made up of 13 election observation experts. And then there are 44 long-term observers who started work there on October 8th. And we'll be working through the election day and after election day. They will be moving around the United States, except in the instances of Texas, California, New York, and Florida, which, as states with the largest number of electoral college votes, we have two long-term observers in each of those states who will be there for the entire process.
What will they be looking for? What would be something that should show that there was a problem with our elections?
Well, it's not a question of looking specifically for a problem with elections. The United States, as an OSCE participating state, has committed itself to invite international election observers from our office, from ODIHR, to come look at the entire electoral process, which will look at such issues as the legal framework, the way complaints and appeals are dealt with, the media environment in general, as well as breadth of coverage, as well as voter and candidate registration, with the goal of assessing those different processes according to OSCE commitments and international standards on democratic elections, as well as on legislation in the places where we observe the elections. And then after that, we will publish a final report which will provide recommendations on how those processes perhaps could be improved.
So you're going to be looking at the way the elections are run and seeing how they can be improved. And people think some people are kind of insulted by that.
Well, the thing is, the OSCE works on basic principles that it's a regional security organization that is based on one of the very basic tenets that security, both for individuals in the OSCE region, for participating states, and within the region itself, can be best ensured through ensuring democratic processes, governments, which includes democratic elections. Now, the United States sends observers to other countries in the OSCE, most recently Armenia, for example, or Georgia, and all of the participating states have agreed that they will accept observers from other participating states to see how processes can be improved. It shouldn't be a case of being insulting. We're here to provide assistance in this question. And there really is no electoral process that couldn't be improved in some way.
The Texas Attorney General Greg Abbott has issued a statement saying that your observers will not be allowed to directly observe the polling here in Texas.
Yes, and this is unfortunate. The director of our office, Ambassador Yanis Lenarchich, today made a statement regarding the statement from the Attorney General, expressing deep concern that international observers would face the threat of criminal prosecution. The thing is, our experience in the United States, we've been observing elections in the United States since 2002 on the invitation of the U.S. federal government. We've worked all across the country. This is our sixth election observation mission to the United States, and we've never had difficulties in the past in instances such as this. We've had great cooperation, actually, from both federal and state-level institutions. So the statement by the Attorney General today is one for concern. We've observed in those five previous instances in Texas and have never run into a situation like this in the past.
So what will you do? Will you stay outside of the polls and try and watch from afar, or will you try to go in and observe?
Well, the thing is, we've also had good cooperation with the U.S. State Department. On this issue, we have been in contact with the State Department. The State Department has been in contact with us. And we're fairly confident that this situation can be sorted out in such a way that it could return to the type of cooperation we've had in the past. It's really not a place for us to speak more about that at present. I think that's a case for the State Department, the federal government, and to discuss these issues with the government in Texas.
Do you recognize that this might just be a misunderstanding, that some people may not understand what it is that you're trying to accomplish, and so if we open up the lines of communication, that they may drop their objections?
Well, we certainly hope that's the case. And instances, I mean, things like this, especially in cases where perhaps election observation missions haven't had such a high profile in the past, I'm not sure that American voters, American citizens, are as aware of what we've been doing in the past. And honestly, what we're saying as far as that we're here to provide assistance, the fact that they may not have been aware of what we're doing in the past, I think shows in that way that there's nothing threatening in this process. We're there to try and provide assistance, technical expertise, and things in that way. So, yeah, I think it's fair to say that perhaps there has been a misunderstanding, and we hope that's the case, and we certainly look forward to having the same kind of cooperation with institutions and state governments that we've always enjoyed in the past.
But there are also factions here in the United States, mainly like the Tea Parties, who are very opposed to the United Nations and anything of that ilk. And this could just be a case of misdirected anger of what they don't like about the UN towards international observers of our elections.
That may well be the case, and I'm familiar with what you mentioned with regard to concerns about the UN. The thing is, first of all, the OSCE, as I said, is a regional security organization that was partly founded by the States and is not the UN. Second of all, as I said, this is a case of making recommendations and often providing follow-up in the way of legal opinions or technical expertise to try and help with the process. I think there has been a fair bit of misunderstanding as to what we do, and we may have been confused with other organizations, but those questions as far as what those organizations do really have to be addressed to them. We're very open about what we're doing, very transparent, and we hope that will get through and that people will understand.
Thomas Reimer is a spokesperson of the OSCE Office for Democratic Institutions and Human Rights. They are being warned by Texas Attorney General Greg Abbott not to observe the election process in Texas. The Texas education system went on trial this week in a Travis County District courtroom. Hundreds of school districts are arguing that the way Texas funds education is hopelessly broken. The lawyers for the poorer school districts say there isn't enough money coming in from Austin to provide the education that the lawmakers demand. Property wealthy school districts say they can't support the share the wealth system. And charter schools are also involved in the case. They want more deregulation and more state funds. The case has the potential to dramatically reshape education in Texas and how we're going to pay for it, including higher taxes coming from where we don't know. But the first question has to be settled. Is the present system violating the state constitution? Tedra Robertson is the communication director for the Equity Center, which is involved in the case, and she sat through this week's testimony.
Okay, the school finance system was put on trial because several parties felt that the system following the education cuts was unconstitutional. So we were the first party in which to file, which is the Texas Taxpayer and Student Fairness Coalition. We're made up of approximately, I believe the total now is 439 school districts, and we represent about 1.3 million school children. So then we've got the Fort Bend ISD group, and they're kind of made up of Chapter 41s and Chapter 42 schools. They represent about 1.8 million kids, and I believe they've got about 80 or so school districts that are signed on to them. Then you've got Calhoun County ISD, which is typically your Chapter 41 or your richer school districts, which has also filed suit. And then you have MALDEF, which is filed on behalf of five districts, typically down in like the Valley area. Then, let's see, you've got the Charter School Association, and they are the most recently added group. So they filed suit, and then the judge went ahead and allowed them to come in.
So it sounds like that there's a consensus on one thing, that there's something wrong with the system, but everyone's coming at it from different directions. The wealthier school districts are tired of paying into a system where they see a lot of inefficiencies. Poorer school districts are saying they're not getting enough money to deal with the demands that are coming from the TEA and the state legislature, and also the business community. They're seeing that the dollars that are being poured into the system are not being spent efficiently.
Well, and the difference between, I would say, all of the school districts that are involved in the party are all fighting for more money. So even the districts, Dr. Kay Wagner from Richardson ISD testified earlier this week, and she's from a Chapter 41 school, prominently known as kind of a wealthier school, and they are subject to recapture. But even she said in her testimony, testified earlier this week, and she's from a Chapter 41 school, prominently known as kind of a wealthier school, and they are subject to recapture. But even she said in her testimony that they don't have enough money. They don't have enough resources in which to meet the needs of their kids.
Well, there's the state constitution. There's all sorts of limits on the way that the state can generate money. One of them is no income tax. And also, there's not supposed to be a statewide property tax. And isn't the argument that this kind of system has kind of turned into a statewide property tax, and that's also why it may be unconstitutional?
That's part of what is being argued is the statewide de facto tax, yes.
Tell me about the judge and what's his demeanor like.
So Judge Dietz, the question that he continues to ask this week as witnesses testify is, so what? Tell me why and tell me more. One of his things when people say, you know, we don't have enough money and we don't have enough resources and the budget cuts have affected us, he wants to know, why have they affected you? How directly have they affected you? And he's asking the witnesses to go into more detail. It really looks like he's prepping to have as much testimony as possible on record for a Supreme Court review of this case.
If when he does rule one way or the other, we don't know which way, it's going to go to the Texas Supreme Court.
We're fairly certain that once he rules one way or the other, it will go to the Supreme Court.
And when the Supreme Court rules on something, then they'll kick it to the legislature.
That's correct. When the Supreme Court rules, it'll kick to the legislature. Timeline-wise, we're thinking that Judge Dietz will probably rule pretty quickly. The trial should wrap up at the end of January. We expect to hear a ruling, a verbal one at least, pretty soon after that. So I'd say the beginning of February. And then we don't know how long it'll take for the Supreme Court to pick it up. And then once they hear it. So it could be into 2014 before we have any real answer.
Right. But the school districts are saying they don't have enough money now to deal with the demands that are being put upon them now, and the demands are only going to get tougher from the TEA.
Correct. The overarching testimony that we are hearing from superintendents and witnesses that are testifying from schools that are both Chapter 41 and Chapter 42 are that they do not have enough resources and that they need more money to meet those resources, they need more money to be able to afford the resources to make sure that their children can meet the ongoing demands of the curriculum.
This goes to the legislature eventually. If along the line it's ruled unconstitutional, the legislature is going to be told, you're going to have to find more money to fix these problems. I don't know how they'll do that. I mean, are there any recommendations from anybody? Is there any vision for where this needs to go?
That, I believe, was part of what the Joint Committee was trying to figure out over the summer. The last panel that met, there was Dick Levine and from CPPP and a few others that testified about different options and what they could look into. They were really focusing on the innovation of a system and how can we upend what we have and come up with something completely new. And they talked about options such as raising the sales tax or going to a statewide property tax, what the repercussions of those options would be. So.
Right. And this would be the Texas legislature. Those guys, you know, the ones that refuse to raise taxes no matter what.
Right. Exactly. So it'll be up to the Texas legislature to decide where to find the money if the court says you have to find it.
Okay. So what happens now? More testimony?
We'll continue with testimony next week. It'll continue on through the middle of December, and we'll take a break for the holidays, and then we'll be back in January. Most of the school districts and then the charter school will testify before the Christmas holidays, and then we'll come back and we'll hear from the interveners in the state in January. So we started off with the demographer who kind of talked about the trends in Texas and what we're looking at and how it's changed. So not only has the population increased specifically with the Hispanic part of our state, one of the interesting facts that he noted in testimony on Monday was that 250 counties in Texas out of the 254 had a noticeable increase in the Hispanic population. The other ones, he said, is pretty close, and he couldn't quite call them, but by the next time, it probably will be. All 254 counties. And then he also noted the trend of poverty and how it is increasing in the state, and that's been a reoccurring theme between all of the superintendents and other experts as they've testified this week about how their children and trying to meet their needs. It is a different demographic than it was 10 years ago.
I read some things about there's a pending crisis. A crisis is coming. Is that what they mean by that?
Part of the pending crisis. So I believe that Judge Dietz was referencing, and I could be wrong on this, but I think it was former Lieutenant Governor Ratcliffe when he testified. I guess it was about 8 years ago that there was a crisis coming. And if we didn't do something to prepare for it, that it was going to be worse than what we ever imagined. And the testimony from the superintendents this week have said, you know, it's no longer the crisis is coming, the crisis is here. We don't have enough money to meet the needs of our children. We have higher standards that they have to meet. And it's not a matter of the kids not wanting to do it. They absolutely do, and they're totally capable of it. They just don't have the resources in which to provide the teachers or the aides or the materials in which to prepare these kids for these tests.
Tedra Robertson is the communication director for the Equity Center, which is involved in the lawsuit against the state of Texas, accusing the state school finance system of being unconstitutional due to the funding cuts from Austin, the broken property tax system, and the increasingly difficult state-mandated standardized test. At least 6 weeks of testimony is expected before the judge issues a ruling in the case early next year. During the past couple of years, there have been plenty of commemorations and celebrations about the sesquicentennial of the Civil War, but there was one historic Civil War event in Gainesville, Texas, that happened 150 years ago this month that passed without official recognition. It was the Great Hanging at Gainesville. It claimed the lives of over 40 men, who were basically lynched because they may have had opinions against slavery and were unsympathetic to the cause of the South. L.D. Clark is a historian, author, and a descendant of one of the hanging victims, and he's written the afterword to the book, The Great Hanging at Gainesville, 1862.
What made it so great was that a Confederate mob threw a kangaroo court and sometimes by direct mob action hanged 42 men, Unionists, in this county. This county voted 2-1 against secession. There was a war simmering under the surface after it all started. There was resistance to the Confederate draft, a great many other things that caused the Unionists in the county to form a secret organization who were actually plotting an insurrection against the Confederacy. They never had done anything except talk. They had performed no action of aid and comfort to the enemy, as you might say, for treason. But they were jerked up by what constituted a mob, a Confederate mob, and we went through a kind of a 3-week reign of terror in this town, in which finally 40 men were hanged and 2 were shot trying to escape. So they were Unionists. They were loyal citizens of the United States of America and didn't give a damn about the Confederacy. So that's why they got hanged.
This is a part of Texas, North Texas, not really close to the South, almost closer to Kansas, where there was a lot of bloodshed up there.
That's right, and it is often associated with Bleeding Kansas. And the Confederates, some of them who've tried to justify this thing over and over, tried to say that there was connection between those who planned to rise against the Confederacy down here, that there was communication between them and Jayhawkers in Kansas. But it was never proved at all. All that was ever proved against him in these trials that took place was that they were members of this secret organization and that they were planning to seize arms and rise up against the Confederacy. But talk is all there ever was to it. And that they would have been guilty if they'd been tried by rule of law. They probably would have been found guilty of conspiracy. But conspiracy is not a capital crime. The legislature had already set down rules for prison terms from 2 to 10 years for disloyalty to the even for disloyalty and even for treason against the Confederacy.
But Texas was under martial law at the time under the Confederacy.
It was under martial law. And Jefferson Davis himself ended the martial law during the time the hangings were going on here, and he had been raising the dickens with General Hebert, who had imposed the martial law in Texas. So, yes, it was under martial law. And, in fact, James Borland, who was Colonel James Borland, was a provost marshal here. He could conceivably have court-martial these men. But if he had, he would have had to follow the rules of court-martials, and what they would have been convicted of would be he would be answerable to his superiors. Whereas the kangaroo court that made itself up by electing people and deciding by majority rule and sometimes not even trying men at all, they made up their rules as they went. So he did not take the route of court-martial. The same thing nearly happened in Sherman, just Grayson County, one county east of here. They sent the men that they rounded up over 20 men who were members of this same organization. It had spread throughout North Texas. They sent these men to Tyler as a change of venue in order for them to get a fair trial. And that when they got down there, the Confederate judge let them go. Most of them go on bail for a couple of $100s, and they never showed up again, and nobody went after them. There were only 2 or 3 that were finally tried by rule of law, by actual court, Confederate court in Tyler, and they were acquitted.
Now, this reign of terror and mob action was not isolated to that part of Texas. I mean, there were instances, I believe, where German immigrants on Nueces River, they were killed. Other Confederate soldiers who were on leave were killed for being accused of being deserters. There was a lot of anarchy and mob action across the state.
There certainly was. Texas was full of Unionists. I mean, this whole state, there was great, great, resistance to the Confederacy. You're talking about what to, there's a monument now in Comfort, Texas, I believe is where it is, to this group of German immigrants who were trying to make it to Mexico and who were massacred by a sizable unit of the Confederate Army. They were pursued and massacred. They called it a battle, but it wasn't much of a battle to it. It was mainly just killing Unionists by the Confederate hotheads.
And people also make reference to the Texas Troubles, which happened in 1860, which led to secession, which was also a kind of an outbreak of mob rule and lynchings across the state.
Well, there were, but then there was also this outbreak. I think this was in 60 when there were a lot of fires up here in North Texas, and people thought that the abolitionists were starting an insurrection. It pretty well turned out to be proved that it was a bunch of matches that went, faulty matches that went off during the very hot summer here in Texas. So there was never anything proved like that.
There's a lot of romanticism about Texas and the West and the Civil War and pioneer days. I don't see these types of episodes in my Hopalong and Cassidy type portrayal of Texas.
Well, no. The country was at war. After all, we were divided between Unionists and Confederates, and there was as much of a war under the surface here in Cook County as there was anywhere. I wanted to say this about Gainesville. We wanted the local historical museum to sponsor a commemoration on the 150th anniversary of the Great Hanging, which was the 12th and 13th of October. Well, the city chickened out on us. They even threatened to cut off funding for the Morton Museum if they sponsored this. Well, we, the Clark family, and in the main, my niece, Colleen Clark Carey, took this over, and we arranged this and got in touch with descendants of at least six or eight of the victims, and we had over 200 people here on the 13th of October, which was the very day that my great-grandfather, Nathaniel Miles Clark, was one of the men hanged. And he was hanged on the 13th of October, 1862. And my family has never forgotten that. This city has always tried to sweep this thing under the rug, but we didn't let them do it. We sponsored it anyway and had a good turnout. The Sons of Confederate Veterans made a so-called documentary here, and they showed it at the Masonic Temple that same day. They had about 40 people who turned out. I understand. I didn't go to it. But we had over 200, and so that was great. But I'll tell you what we're going to do. We are going to organize after the first of the year, go before the city council here, and we are going to try to make the city of Gainesville allow us to put up a marker up on the square here in Gainesville commemorating these men and pointing out just what happened, not any great defense or attack, but just to state what happened.
L.D. Clark is a historian, author, and a descendant of one of the hanging victims of the Great Hanging in Gainesville. He has written the afterword to the book, The Great Hanging at Gainesville, 1862. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. We'd like to hear from you about the program. Send us an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. There are past Texas Matters programs online at tpr.org, and you can download the free podcast on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.